Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to episode 24 of AI Movie Night. I'm your host, Joe Simpson, and tonight I'm joined, as usual, by two great guests to discuss a great film. In this case, it's the instant classic, really, Baby Driver. And before I go any further, anyone listening, we're obviously going to talk about the film, every aspect. We're going to spoil it from the start to the end. So please, if you haven't seen it yet, please watch it before hopefully coming and listening to this. There's so much to talk about, so I'm going to get straight down to it. Firstly, I'm just going to introduce my first guest. It's Rory Greenfield, the regular on the AI Movie Night and the co-host of the excellent AI Comic Pod. How are you, Rory?
I'm good, man. It's good to be back. It's been a little while. I'm surprised you've only done 24 of these, you know. That's what's so shocking when you just said it then. Plenty more to cover, man.
Oh, definitely. It's so often we've had technical problems or things set up. And, you know, so as you say, there's plenty more to come. Obviously, we've had some technical problems tonight, but we've got through them now.
Just a couple. We're ready.
We're definitely ready. I'm also lucky enough to be joined by the birthday boy, Luke Chanley, who's a writer for Get Into This and Anfield Index, amongst a number of others. How are you, Luke?
Yeah, very well, thanks. Very well indeed. Looking forward to getting stuck in and chatting about, like you say, an instant classic. So yeah, should be good.
Oh, that's great. Thanks very much to you both for joining me. As I say, I'm going to get straight into it. Obviously, I know you're both massive fans of Edgar Wright's work. What is it about his films that makes you such a big fan, Rory?
So it's difficult. I could probably talk far too long on the subject of Edgar Wright. It's almost like my chosen topic on Mastermind, I think, which mainly comes down to. So I love Spaced back in the day. So you're going back about 18 years, and Spaced was a Channel 4 kind of offbeat sitcom with Simon Pegg co-writing with Edgar Wright and Nick Frost, which is kind of what formed their relationship, and then they went on to do obviously the Cornetto trilogy, and Edgar Wright's kind of gone a little bit left field and moved over to Canada and then the States and stuff, and it's kind of good to see him evolving. I think Simon Pegg's the same. I always feel a little bit sorry for Nick Frost in this equation, because he's the kind of one that's been left behind a little bit, because you know, Pegg's a kind of A-list superstar since he went on to do Star Trek and he's in all the Mission Impossible films and stuff, but I think it's the writing and his way of storytelling that's always kind of set him apart a little bit. The thing for me, which is quite a surprise, is the big U-turn in his style, because although what Edgar Wright does and what he's known for doing is taking the genres he grew up watching and loving and then converting them into his style of film. So Shaun of the Dead is his kind of take on a zombie apocalypse film. He grew up watching Dawn of the Dead and things of those nature, Ennisin by who's the guy that did all those kind of films? And the other directors of that kind of ilk. And he basically wanted to do something with a British kind of twist on it. And then if you look at Hot Fuzz, it's similar thing. So it's all referenced in the film itself. So it's all Bad Boys and those kind of films, and Point Break and those kind of classic American action films. And then he's kind of gone off and gone, right, I've done that, you know, and the same with the World's End, which is a little bit understated. I kind of liked it. Some people not so much, but it's got some good elements to it. And again, it's great soundtrack and his style of film, taking a lot of kind of sci-fi elements and stuff that he also likes. So he kind of did three genres and three films and made them into a kind of offbeat trilogy in his way. And then he decided to kind of go off and do Scott Pilgrim, which is unlike anything I've seen. And I always rank it as one of my favourite films. People that haven't seen it go, you know, it looks shit, what are you talking about? And then most people that have are generally in complete agreement with me, because if you grew up in my kind of era, so kind of 90s, you know, Mega Drive, SNES, arcades, those kind of things, you know, and then also, you know, played instruments and in bands and all that kind of shit and stuff, it, you know, that is the film that appealed to me most, because it's got so many pop culture references, so many kind of old school gaming references, and it's just the perfect kind of story. And And from there, I just can't get enough of anything Edgar Wright's ever done, really. So I was kind of hotly awaiting this film this year, because although there's some huge releases this summer, I mean, it's such a great summer for film, and such a great year so far, actually, I'd say. But this does stand apart for me as something particularly special. And I kind of always, with the cast and with the move to, well, it's Atlanta, but move to the States, It's a bit of a shift change, and it's kind of very welcome, because I think it's given Edgar Wright a little bit more of a budget and a little bit something different to keep him out of his comfort zone, but equally still give him in, you know, license to make something special, and that's certainly what he's done.
Yeah, I think Rory summed up Edgar Wright's career perfectly there. So many interesting projects, and, you know, if you haven't checked them out, you should do, because, you know, so many people love them, and there's so much quality there going back many, many years. They're definitely worth checking out. What about yourself, Luke? Are you similarly a big fan of Edgar Wright's work?
Yeah, a really big fan, actually. I remember the day that I first saw Shaun of the Dead, and I think we bought it on Skybox Office. Like, I haven't bought anything on Skybox Office probably in the 10 years since I watched the film. But it was, I mean, mum and dad sat down and they were like, I've heard this film's great. I mean, mum and dad aren't film people, so I was like, well, it's obviously going to be crap, isn't it, if you're saying that. But anyway, I was like, I'll crack on Family Day or whatever. And I kind of remember, like, I don't know if I even Googled it. I don't know if even it was back then I Googled things. But and I thought, I'm not keen on this. It looks a bit of a naff kind of parody. I was like, oh, I'm not sure. And within the first 10 minutes, I was like, how haven't I seen this already? I hadn't heard of it before I saw it that day. And I was just, from that day, I was hooked. And from that day, I was waiting for Hot Fuzz. Then you had The World's End. And that was like, I was like really big into kind of that, the Cornetto trilogy, which is what pushed me to Space. And I had Space on DVD for years. And I just really like, I think what I like the most about the way he approaches his films, it's almost like a caricature of the genre that he's taken off. So it's not almost poking fun, but it's like paying homage in a really fun way and a really unique kind of way. So you've got the zombie apocalypse. I mean, it's not scary, Shaun of the Dead, but, you know, it's got its kind of brutal moments, but it's still very, very fun. It doesn't poke fun at, but it almost has fun with the genre, which I really like. Again, Hot Fuzz was a really kind of, even though it was set in like a unfashionable, unstylish British town, I think it's quite a understated and stylish film in the way kind of it approaches all the action scenes. Very Edgar Wright in that respect. And The World's End I was a bit disappointed with, but then again, I've only seen it once, and I'm a notorious changer of minds when I watch a film a second time, so I do need to watch that again But I think it's just kind of the fun element that comes with all of his films. Like Scott Pilgrim, I rewatched it again today in the build up to this show, and it's just such a fun film. Like it's almost how graphic novel films possibly should be in a way. Not dissimilar to how I feel about Baby Driver. Is almost once you've seen that film, for me being an Edgar Wright fan, it was, why aren't all films like this? Like, why doesn't everyone pay this much attention to like their job? If they're liking their job, why don't they? And it's just such
I think that just sets him apart as a director, though, mate. Because yeah. I think that's the thing with directors. A lot of people don't, and I'm known for it, right? And Stu will tell you from the comic pod that I don't shut up about direction of film and cinematography and the way things are done.
Yeah.
But I kind of understand how important they are. And I always think people go, oh, it's all about the cast and all this and the soundtrack and stuff. I'm like, yeah, but who brings all that into a story? Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Because you look at films like the latest King Kong film, which had an incredible cast and actually had a really good soundtrack, and the locations were ridiculous. You know, they shot in Vietnam, in New Zealand, in all these great places. Huge budget, but it's a shit film. Well, it's a shit film in comparison to what it should be, because you've got actors like Tom Hiddleston, you've got, you know, Brie Larson and stuff. And it's just so, it's all about the story and the direction, and the director having the balls to really to do it their way. And I was a bit worried about this project, because you see Edgar Wright, who's worked with, you know, Scott Pilgrim has got some slightly bigger actors, a lot that have gone in other superhero genres, but probably before they got that big, like Chris Evans and Brandon Rouse and various people. Michael Cera's probably the least intimidating actor in Hollywood, so I can't imagine he's that difficult to work with. But you've got all these kind of younger, quite trendy actors, but none of which they kind of would make you nervous directing them. But you go into this and you've got Jamie Foxx, who is a notoriously huge personality on the set, and then you've got people like Kevin Spacey. And I mean, Jesus Christ, imagine trying to direct Kevin Spacey to anything. He will be directing you, basically, because he's that experienced and that good. And I just think I was a bit nervous about him going into this and such a bold, big project, but I think it just shows that what a capable director he is. And I think what respect he probably got from his cast that they deliver his film, because that's the thing with it. It's very much his film. And I think that's what's kind of been a trend for this year and a lot of the directors and stuff, because we talked about Logan and James Marigold did that. And Logan is very much a director's movie, where I think if the studio had their way, they wouldn't have made such a bold decision, perhaps, to kill off, and this is another spoiler if you are listening and haven't seen Logan, but to kill off Wolverine, to kill off Hugh Jackman, you know. And I think it was time, but they also did it with Patrick Stewart, which is just a huge thing to do. And I just think that's why it's such a positive year, especially with La La Land as well, because I just got to put that out there, because again, directors don't make films like that very often. Do you know what I mean? And if you look at Whiplash, and they probably thought, right, this guy's got something about him, but then they let him go and make this film that's obviously won, you know, dozen Oscars or whatever, which is ridiculous. But I really like it. I think it's a great film. But it's one of those films that, again, it's nice this year because you're getting directors really stamping their vision rather than the studios just taking over and telling them what to do, which is, I think, what we've had for a lot of years in cinema. So, yeah, I think that's why I'm quite buzzing about cinema this year, because there's so many good things at the minute.
Yeah, no, couldn't agree more. And I think the good thing as well is, obviously, it is a business at the end of the day, and a good thing is the studios have been rewarded both financially and critically.
Yeah,
by these talented younger directors, you know, bigger budgets and more free reign to put their own stamp on them, as you say, and, you know, clearly it's worked. I think one of the things I love about Edgar Wright, similarly to you both, he's kind of like a massive film nerd.
Oh, huge.
Who is blessed with this sort of extremely gifted talent, and brings so much of his film knowledge and love to his own films, but in a way, like he's both said, in a way that it does pay homage, but it's still very much an Edgar Wright film. It takes it in a different angle or puts a different spin on it, and in a way that gives a lot of respect to those other films, but also, you know, gives it a different tint as well. And just, I've got to go back to this just because I love this story. It's funny you mentioned about Simon Pegg earlier on becoming a superstar. The funny quote I read by Edgar Wright is where he said in one of the interviews, just after Shaun of the Dead, I think it was, he said something like, you know, Simon Pegg said, "It's not like I'm going to go off to Hollywood and start making Mission Impossible films." And obviously, you know, it's funny how things could change around, isn't it? But yeah, no.
It's mad with Simon Pegg, you know. I mean, putting it in perspective, because I really like the guy and I think he's very charismatic. And he's a good actor. I think he's got a bit more range at times than he's given credit for. I mean, Hot Fuzz, the guy got in shape, do you know what I mean? He was taking it seriously. It's kind of a weird thing, especially after, I think he had to wear a fat suit for Run, Fat Boy, Run, because he'd just been filming Hot Fuzz, where he's in the shape of his life, and then he had to go off and do that.
A film called Run, Fat Boy, Run,
yeah. Yeah, one of the worst films I can remember in the last so many years. But no, not great. But, you know, I drove through the town where they filmed Hot Fuzz last year. It's in the kind of, well, it's near Bath, that kind of, that part of the country. And I absolutely adore it, man, because to me, it's the film that mostly only British people get. Mm-hmm. And I remember I was travelling when it came out about 10 years ago, and I was in Australia and I watched it there. I think I watched it at cinema twice in Melbourne because I absolutely loved it. I just thought the audience were going, what the hell is this? They probably like the action elements, and it's quite brutal, man, especially there's a couple of scenes where, you know, the guy gets impaled with the spire that comes off the, you know, the church or whatever. It's quite a shocking film at times, but the humour in it is so British. And I just don't think people would have maybe got that. And I kind of liked that about it. I felt like he's a director directing something for us for a change a little bit. You know what I mean? It's kind of felt a little bit like that. Because I think British film was struggling at that time. I think it's kind of had a bit of a renaissance. And some of the studios are, you know, all the studios that are here, Pinewood and all the big ones. And you get Star Wars over here and stuff now. So it's a big change. But yeah, I think Edgar Wright is kind of a big part of a relaunching, you know, British film. And again, you know, this film's got, what, a $35 million budget or something? It's not like he's working on, you know, I think the next one, he's got an open checkbook. I think for most studios, you know, they're going to go, right, there you go, make what you want to make, no restrictions. I heard him talking, he was on the Empire podcast, and he was a great interview, and he was saying that the studio was trying to get him to cut the chase scene in Baby Driver. And he basically sacrificed, I think, three days of his wages or whatever it was to get it, you know, a big cut of his salary to get it, you know, made to fund the actual project, because he's saying, it's all about the driving, it's not about the chase scene. And the chase scene happens to be one of the finest scenes in the film, if not, for me, up there as the finest. And it kind of shows the commitment of the director, but also shows the budget restraints. Do you know what I mean? I mean, they were clearly a bit nervous about this, and I they needn't be anyway. Let's put it that way.
I think just putting in, just before we move on to the next bit in the agenda, I think what's really important, if we're going to probably talk about Wright's career, is the Ant-Man situation.
I talk about this most days.
I think it's really interesting because, I mean, I was unsure about the situation, but being a Wright fan, obviously, kind of just trusted his judgment. But then when he backed away, I wonder how maybe creatively the Marvel team behind that feel after such a fantastically creative follow up in Baby Driver. I think because. You guys may know more what happened, but it seemed like creative differences and maybe restrictions, which is kind of buzzed around the Marvel situation a bit recently as well, I think. I've heard a few different things, but I think that would probably go to show quite a lot about his ambitions, both in general, but also like on a project-by-project basis, because I think if if things aren't going to go right for him, he's just going to walk away. And in a way, that's probably a really, really good way to kind of go about your career, especially in directing, where you are making a mold for yourself in every single film you do. And I think the fact that he walked away from that, which was actually, to be fair, a really, really good film. And I know he wrote most of it, didn't he, still? But I think that whole year and a half is quite an interesting part of his career, isn't it? Even though essentially it didn't end up being turn out that he was directing the film.
No, it's, I know enough about it because we talked about it a few times before. I'm still a little bit gutted about it because I just think Paul Rudd under Edgar Wright's kind of guise would have just been incredible. I still think, look, don't get me wrong, Ant-Man is a good film, and I think what Marvel always do, and I think they do extremely successfully, is they always guide their films in the right kind of direction. Do you know what I mean? And if you go to see Spider-Man, you can feel the Marvel element in Spider-Man, which you wouldn't have got if it was just a Sony-produced film. You know, I think Kevin Feige and his team and all the rest of it really do know what makes audiences tick and what makes the kind of true comic book fans tick at the same instance. But
yeah.
I think what happened essentially is that Edgar's story, and he was in pre-production for it was almost 10 years. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, it was years, wasn't it?
I think it was before Scott Pilgrim, but it was something that he is quite stuck in his ways, I think, in the regard of he wants his vision to be properly done, you know. And I think if people were starting interfering with his script and doing rewrites, which is what they wanted to do, he wrote it with Adam and Joe, but just Adam from Adam and Joe, I think, from back in the day. I think he wrote Attack the Block as well. And they're both, I think it's Adam Cornish, they're both still on the writing credits. But Edgar Wright hasn't seen it. Which I heard him say, which is kind of gutting.
Really?
Yeah, he's never seen it. He must feel quite bitter towards it. And it's not the first time. I mean, Josh
Whedon, I think he said he'll never watch it, didn't he? I think it's not bad.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think that's the thing. It was his baby. He did all the groundwork. He did all the scripts. And then I think his story was a little bit more around Michael Douglas's character rather than around Paul Rudd, so I think maybe the studio was coming at it from a slightly different angle. I still think it's a massive shame, and I think Marvel potentially might be kicking themselves. I think, you know, you look at Josh Whedon, who's gone off to finish up Justice League because of the issues with Zack Snyder, and then he's going to do Batgirl and stuff, and he did Avengers and then Age of Ultron and fell out with the studio badly over Age of Ultron due to interference and various other things. I still think it holds up as a really good film, but I think it could have been maybe a bit more special, and he's now left to go to DC and Warner Brothers, and I think, you know, maybe Edgar Wright might do the same, and eventually, do Marvel care? They're still grossing $1 billion for most of their films, so maybe they don't care. It's one of those things, isn't it? But you don't really want to burn the most talented directors knocking about, you know, and I think that's what they really have done in this situation. So yeah, I think it's disappointing. On the other side of it, maybe he wouldn't have felt as inspired to go off and do Baby Driver yet, you know. Maybe he would have gone and done something else after that, and you know, you never know what could have happened. So if it's inspired him to go and do this now, then I think we're all the better for it, because this is, you know, as much as I love Marvel, and no one better listen to this if it, like Stu or Gags, this film and these kind of films are more what I live for in cinema, you know what I mean? This film is exceptional, but it's again, it's like nothing else. That's what's great about films like this, because they are. And how many films have been made in the course of history, and you still get original productions that are completely different. And that's why Edgar Wright's pretty special, because not many directors can make original films. Even though the story is quite known, it still feels completely new, completely fresh.
Totally. And obviously that leads us nicely on. Obviously, clearly you both absolutely adore this film, and obviously there was a danger in the build-up. There was so much hype, and then straight after, the critics gave it glowing reviews. There was always that question of, did it live up to your expectations? It sounds like it really did, Luke.
Yeah, it did.
completely, to be honest with you. I don't know whether this helped or not, but when I saw that, I think when I saw the trailer initially, I was excited, but it almost, you know how sometimes when you see a trailer and you're like, all the best bits of the film are in that trailer, like, I'm going to only be disappointed with the film. I almost kind of think the trailer kind of downplayed the film a little bit, so if anything, it only slightly maybe dampened my expectations, but I still went in, and from the very first minute, I had just a big cheesy grin on my face until the very last minute when the credits rolled in, and I remember turning to my friend and just going, well, I just didn't know what to say. It was just so magnificent, and I'm really glad that it did live up to like my expectations. And there's also people who I know who aren't movie fans, particularly. I don't know what else these people are doing, but they're not movie fans, and they're kind of saying, yeah, that was a really good film, I really like that. And it's nice to see it's not just me and those guys who think it's great and kind of similarly minded people. It generally is a great film, isn't it? And that's kind of my summary in general, really. Like, we could end the podcast there, and I think that'll be we can end there, but let's just talk about it forever. I thought it was ace. Yeah, I loved it.
No, you're right. I think it's something special. It's like I was quite similar at the end of it. I was just like, I've never seen anything like that before. Obviously, I've seen similar elements and things, but never that level of action combined with that level of the music and the choreography and all perfectly, skillfully matched up in a way that just has you sort of, it's almost like your brain doesn't know what to do, because music and action and, you know, so many things happening at once together, perfectly in sync. It's just, as I say, I've never seen anything like it, and it's just a joy from start to finish. What about yourself, Rory?
Yeah, I just echo that. I just, for the record, if Luke had ended the pod right there, then I know it's his birthday, but I still would have hunted him down. That wouldn't have been a happy time for me. I think something Luke mentioned about the audience, and this is big for me, is that I always want Edgar Wright to find success, because I think he's a director that really earns it. You know, he earns his craft. And like you said, you know, why can't all directors put that much effort into their films? But not all directors do. Do you know what I mean? I mean, Michael Bay, let's be honest, he will churn out any old shit for audiences and without a care in the world. Do you know what I mean? And that guy had skill. Do you know what I mean? But now we're 5 Transformers films in, it's just going to be the same old horrible films over and over again. And that's the frustrating thing with some of these directors, that they're basically a waste of their talents and what they can do. And it's either they choose the wrong script and the cast and all the rest of it. But, you know, good directors tend not to make mistakes. And I think good directors, for me, or the really special ones, are the ones that write and produce and direct and basically see a film from start to finish. And I think what we talked about with Ant-Man and stuff is the same principle. I think if you're that committed to the film you're looking to make, that's why maybe has that kind of impact on a director, because you say take Nolan out of a production halfway through, you imagine the uproar. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Imagine the meltdown, because he and it's the same. You know, Fincher doesn't necessarily write. He picks great scripts and you know, works with them. But a lot of the directors, you know, that see the process all the way through, Peter Jackson and Edgar Wright and those, it's different to them. And I think that's what you're getting. You're getting a director's, you know, this is his long-term vision, and that's the big thing with these films, is he had this in his mind, probably like he did with these other films, when he was watching films when he was younger. Do you know what I mean? He was already writing scripts and thinking of ideas, and that's, you know, to have that commitment to make a film over that length of their career, you know, is pretty special, because you can't just go off and make a film like this. You know, you've got to build up to a film like this. And yeah, I just think it deserves the audiences it seems to be getting. And you know, it's 100% on Rotten Tomatoes from almost day one. And yeah, the critics obviously love it and have been waxing lyrical about it since it kind of was aired at Venice or whatever it was, you know, earlier in the year. the dates got moved. I think it got moved in release earlier in the year because of the hype around it, which is kind of smart. And it feels like the studio's really reacted to it. And it feels like audiences and looking at numbers are responding, and everyone I know has seen it absolutely loves it. And it's not just people who like Edgar Wright or like music or like, you know, it's a combination of things. It is a very different film. I think some people might not like it, and I think only, I don't know who these people are, but I think it's very intricate and it's very clinical. And I know people have said at Scott Pilgrim that they don't like the quick jumping of scenes. Do you know what I mean? So you get these scenes, 1 minute he's you know, dreaming, the next minute he's in another location straight away, and then the next minute it's very quick frames. And some people find that quite jolting. I find it almost ingenious, do you know what I mean? Like directors that do that, 500 Days of Summer, I always go back to, where it's very clever about flipping between the different days. And I just think it's films that do that and directors that do that, I just have so much admiration for, because you can imagine the days and hours and weeks spent in the production side of things. You know, they just must be just in there just creating this film, and it's not just about the way it's shot at the beginning, it's all the production and post-production and everything that goes into it. And I just think you can feel the love that's gone into this film. Like you know, you imagine the strain, you know, these kind of directors with these, I think Edgar Wright said he had like 70,000 songs on his iPod, which, I mean, I know yours broke earlier, Joe, but you imagine losing 70,000 songs, that would just be devastating. And he's the kind of guy that probably, you know, I debated what came first when I wrote an article about this, which should be out in conjunction with this.
Excellent.
About, you know, yeah, it's subtle enough. about what came first, whether it's the scene or the songs, you know what I mean? Because the music is synchronized like I've never seen. And you can talk about, you know, James Gunn, and I love Guardians, and the music fits so well. The soundtracks are really well done. And High Fidelity and these kind of soundtracks and films that I've always loved and Almost Famous and stuff. Scott Pilgrim, for putting out there, is an incredible soundtrack with original music on as well. But it's very rare that music is linked into a film, or actually it's never been done like this before. Do you know what I mean? Let's be honest. I don't think I've ever seen anything like this. But there's more to this film than that. There is more to this film than just the action and the soundtrack. And that's what it has got. A real kind of undercurrent to it, a really good heart, and I really love the two leads. I think their just chemistry is just incredible.
Well, that leads us on nicely. We were just going to look at the character of Baby in particular, and the performance of Ansel Elgort. What were your thoughts on those things, Rory?
I think he's great. Actually, I hadn't really known what to expect of him, because I just give him a lot of courage for, you know, stepping on set. He's 2021. He's stepping on set with Kevin Spacey, and he doesn't look remotely out of place. Do you know what I mean? And I always think, and you've got big other actors in this, you know, talking Jamie Foxx and John Hamm and stuff, but John Bernthal is an incredibly intimidating actor from at least his, you know, his roles. Do you know what I mean? And it doesn't seem like it.
He's got a presence and a half, hasn't he?
Mate, he's got a presence and a half. Yeah, if you've seen Daredevil and The Punisher, the role he plays in that, man, I would be nervous stepping onto set with John Bernthal. And even people like Flea. I mean, I loved that he was in this as albeit a cameo kind of thing, because he's I don't know if people know who Flea is, they must do, but he's the bass player from the Red Hot Chili Peppers. And I think the only other memorable acting role is he was in Back to the Future, wasn't he, back in the day? I don't know if you remember that.
I can't remember who he was. I can just remember reading it somewhere.
He was definitely one of Biff's kind of cronies, I remember. But anyway, he plays almost the identical part. If you go watch Back to the Future, you'll see he's almost the same, which is ridiculous. But I just, people like him, man, he's such a big personality. Do you know what I mean? And I just think this kid comes on to set. I don't know how much acting he's got behind him. I know he was in, I've seen The Fault in Our Stars, which is a big kind of teen book, and I've seen that, and he's pretty good in that. But it's nothing like this. Do you know what I mean? And I think he's perfect. I think he's... The only thing that I've read and I kind of in agreement with. He's supposed to be a little bit more awkward than he is. And, mm-hmm. and I think he's socially awkward because he's not really had any time around people. For a guy that's socially awkward, he's quite smooth talking.
Super smooth. Than anyone I've ever seen who's socially awkward.
That's my thing. And when he's kind of dancing through the city, I mean, that scene at the beginning, you know, it's very Scott Pilgrim-esque actually, when all the words are flashing and across the screen in different areas and stuff. It's so clever. But he plays that so well. And yeah, I mean, this film for me, he just fits it perfectly. I think him and Lily James, and they're just a really good on-screen couple. And they don't spend an awful lot of time together, let's be honest. And this film just races along at a crazy pace, you know. But the scenes when it slows it down with those two in the diner and when they're in the laundromat and stuff, I think it's great. I think he just fits it perfectly. And I think he fits the action role as well for a guy, you know, he looks ridiculously nimble, you know, when he's chasing across the cars and he's jumping over a car, didn't he? Yeah, he did. So, I mean, yeah, I think he's got a pretty bright future, to be honest. I mean, there's a lot of good actors and actresses, you know, in Hollywood at this stage, young ones. But he looks like, he will probably walk into his next job quite comfortably, let's put it that way.
Yeah, and as you say, if you can hold your own against Oscar winners like Fox and Spacey and John Hamm, who I just think is incredible in everything.
He's amazing, yeah.
You know, if you can be in scenes with them and hold your own, you're doing something right, particularly at that age. And you mentioned, obviously, the character, his relationship with Deborah. And as you say, obviously, there's so many things in this film, but the key thing in a relationship like that, for me anyway, is do you like these people? Do you want them to get together and stay together? And very much so. They were both so likeable together. And yeah, just, you know, brilliant work by both. What about yourself, Luke? What were your thoughts on the character of Baby and the performance?
I think there's not much you can really add. I think he just did really well, because I mean I reviewed the film a couple of weeks ago, and I even commented on the fact that a lot his previous acting was like his credits were very different to this. They were almost a little bit lighter, and he's kind of come in and he's not putting a particularly heavy performance, but I think in a few scenes there's a lot of different contrasting emotions you've got. For example, as Rory said, the beginning scene where he's like dancing through the street, and there's the scenes with his foster father where he's dancing around there, very, very light. But then, of course, you've got the diner scene, which is very, I mean, incredibly tense. I was so tense in that scene. And he plays it. He almost doesn't play it, but like in the best way possible. It's very deadpan. But you almost like you can feel what he's going through, and he is doing something by doing nothing at all, and it's really, really good. And the character is fantastic. I mean, it's not a particularly original story as the actual base story, but the way he plays the character is just really nice. I don't think he overhams anything at all. I think it just kind of sits really well, and he does exactly what you would really want from that character, other than maybe this weirdly smooth, how has he not already got a girlfriend and a better life situation? I mean, I don't know what I've got to do, but if he can do that and not have a girlfriend, then I think I've got a lot to go. But
maybe you need to get your music on when you try it, mate. Makes all the difference.
No. Get down to your local Greggs, put some music on.
And just put my glasses on and wait.
Wait for the woman behind the counter to get off shift, and you'll be fine. She'll smell of pasties, and you'll have a great time.
It's all right. And I love it because I love pasties, so it's all right. I think there's not much more you can add. Really, he plays it really well. I really liked his performance. Yeah.
Well, there's so many interesting characters and performances in the film. Are there any others that particularly stand out for you, Luke?
I think there's a lot of obvious kind of partnerships, isn't there? Obviously there's a relationship, both Deborah and Baby, and then you've got Doc and Baby. But I like the relationship between the three like core criminals, which Jamie Foxx, John Hamm, and I forget the name of the female. But the, I think them three, the way it develops through the kind of the final two thirds, like the, probably the main part of the film, is really interesting because they're all quite different personalities almost, and it's almost a bit. It ends very firecracker. It's very firecrackery. It's kind of aggressive, but fits well with the film. I don't think it's overly aggressive, and I like their relationship between them three. I think that's really fun. I like that a lot.
What about yourself, Rory?
Yeah, I mean, that's a, it's a really interesting one because they, for a long time in the film, they're basically, Buddy and Darling are plotting to kill off Jamie Foxx's bats because they know what a risk he is, because he's literally on the brink of a meltdown at any given moment. He's superb in it, to be honest.
Oh, Foxx, yeah.
I think Foxx basically didn't get out of character the whole set, is what I've read, and I'd just be imagined hanging out with him. He must be the scariest guy to hang out with because he's in that crazy get-up and all his tattoos and all the rest of it. He looks amazing. But yeah, their relationship, and when he's in the diner and absolutely nailing Buddy's backstory about coming from Wall Street and, you know, picking up your favourite stripper and all this kind of stuff, which you learn or you can see in John Hamm's face is real, yeah. And it's true. you just don't know what's going to happen next. And I think the one relationship, obviously, Baby and his dad is his foster dad's a really interesting one. And I thought their relationship was really nice. I think there's a lot you talk about with Spacey and his kind of father-son kind of relationship with Baby, and there is some interesting elements. I think for me, that's just Spacey being Spacey.
Yeah, and I think you're right there as well. It's also quite rare. I think, unless, you know, I may be wrong on this, but in these type of films in particular, it's quite rare to have a character, in my experience, who's actually, for a guy who's committing bank robberies and obviously is an extremely dangerous guy, he is quite warm to Baby, and, you know, he clearly likes him and appreciates his skills as well. And I think it's good that the realism in terms of once Baby crosses that line and sort of causes him, obviously, destroys the plans and ultimately ends up with his partner getting killed, I think, and then you see that other side of him come out, and I think it was good to see that, you know, he was his friend and that, but once Baby crossed the line, that was it. And I just echo you both going back to that diner scene. I think it's so good, the tension, you know, Jamie Foxx's bats, I mean, his words are like weapons, you know.
Yeah.
The way he delivers them, and also the fact that there's humour, but, you know, vicious humour often behind them, and also that sort of that intellect, you know, he's razor sharp, and, you know, the tensions rise, and obviously Baby has got his own situation going on with Deborah trying to keep her out of this at the same time that's going on, and you feel almost as if you're there in that diner with them, and it's just a fantastic scene, really. Just,
you know, what that scene reminded me from, just because it actually just came to me then, it's got a bit of a Pulp Fiction vibe to it, you know, that scene. And I think this film, you know, if you listen to Edgar Wright talk about it, he always drops Easter eggs, and, you know, he loves putting actors, and I think there's people who were involved in the music, like Big Boys, Big in Atlanta from Outkast, and people like that were in the film at one stage. I think they were in the restaurant at the bar with Kevin Spacey at one stage, and people like that, you know, and they're on the soundtrack. He loves to do that with the film, but he also, obviously, as we talked about, he has a history of you know, paying homage to different films, you know, and I think you could feel a bit of Tarantino in this film, and not all the time, and it does still very much feel like an Edgar Wright film, but he's doing things what I would do if I ever was in that position. I would take influence from what's around me. He's obviously, you know, all the pop culture and gaming stuff is influenced from his past. He's, you know, it's like Inception, where you can't draw anything from your memory. You have to do it slightly different, you know? And I think that's exactly what he does generally. He takes his experiences and what he loves and then just puts them onto screen in his style. And yeah, that scene is genius. It is, because it signifies a change. And what follows is a completely different film almost. It really is. It's at the beginning, it feels almost a straight action film because there's humour, but not a vast amount. Bar the Mike Myers mask scene, which I thought really made everyone laugh, including me in the cinema. I thought that was genius. But there isn't a whole grate of like Edgar Wright in your face kind of humour that you used to. It was more of a straight action film, and then it suddenly turns in, you know, it's a heist thriller film, and it just becomes a heavy kind of thriller, dramatic kind of film, and it's just such a different feel to it. I think it was a really good... That's a pivotal scene if you look back at the film, as the change of tone.
Yeah, no, totally agree. And I love the fact that it's sort of, obviously we'll discuss it later, I'm sure, but it sort of wrong-foots you, because at that stage you're definitely the clock is ticking, or so you feel, on this clash between Bats and Buddy. You know, we know what Bats is like all the way through. He's talked about how dangerous he is, and obviously just has this air of danger anyway, and we've seen him be dangerous. But equally, Buddy has got this, you know, underlying sort of danger simmering away. And obviously, his girlfriend, and I can't remember her name, apologies there, but she's verbalising how dangerous he is, and you feel that's the way it's going to go. And I like the fact that it wrong foots you and it ends up being Baby who has the clash with Bats, because Baby's clever enough to know what's coming his way from Bats. So, no, just magnificent storytelling, really. Obviously, we've touched a lot on music. Obviously, Edgar Wright is so famous for his use of music in his films. And as we've said, this is pretty much unique, the way he's used it in this. Do you have any favourite scene or music combinations in the film, Rory?
I think any of the scenes when the driving's involved and literally Baby can't go until it's the moment of the song. Do you know what I mean? I think that's just brilliant. For me, there's always one song, and if it's ever used in any film, it's my favourite song in a film, and it's Nowhere to Run by Martha and the Vandellas. Yes. We did a Warriors pod quite a while ago, and that song again in the film is the pivotal song for me, and I kind of love that Motown soul kind of era of music, and I just love that song. I just literally haven't stopped playing it. The other one in there, which I literally had on repeat, and I bought the soundtrack immediately after the cinema, which is very typical of me, is Beck, Deborah. And I saw Beck last year, and he was absolutely incredible. And Beck's just perfect for these kind of films. He's got that kind of white kind of cowboy look, which is bizarre, but it kind of suits the kind of tone of the film. If you see Beck, this style of music, but then he completely adds hip hop beats and stuff to his music. It's the bizarrest twist, and anyone that knows Beck just sees him as perfect. And his lyrics on that song are just hilarious. And I think the clever thing with the music, it's just that it's all about Baby having songs about him, do you know what I mean? And the scene for me that I really liked is when Deborah is talking, like, you know, it's all about her sister having songs named after her, it's not about me, you know. And then they play the T-Rex song, and then there's the Beck song as well, and it's kind of nice because there's not much character development with her to the backstory or what went on, do you know what I mean? You know with Baby what happened, the tragedy and things like that, but you don't get a sense of that with her. But that was kind of a good little, you know, that she's the one that's in the shade all the time, do you know what I mean? And he's maybe making her feel special, and I don't know, it's that's quite pivotal, and that's all done by music, really. There's not much words that have to be spoken, and that's why it's very clever. But it's a really good soundtrack. It's such a great mix of music. I do love anything when, you know, the kind of indie rock stuff when he's driving. I think there's some really good songs on there. Focus by Hocus Pocus, or Hocus Pocus Focus, whichever way around it is cool. And then the Bell Bottoms is pretty good, and there's some other good stuff in there as well.
Yeah, just fantastic soundtrack, as you say. What about yourself, Luke? Any particular combinations of music and scenes stand out for you?
I really like that. Well, the music all the way through is almost a second star in the film, or a third star if you're taking Edgar Wright into that context. But I think there's the scene where they go and meet Doc's contacts in that warehouse. The butcher, it is, isn't it? And
tequila.
The tequila scene. Yeah, and I think what I really like is, and that's kind of almost for me the first time I watched the film, brought into contrast how important music was like halfway through the film, because I think whatever song it was, and I don't know the song off the top of my head, but it's more the scene that sticks in my mind is where the guns are going off to the drum beat. So it's like it's really quick, obviously quick shooting, but the song is going to be quick, and I think that's when you get, and that's what moves on almost to Rory's point about which did come first, the song or the scene, because it seems like the song doesn't come into the scene without the scene, but then the scene doesn't work without the song, and you're kind of thinking, what's going on? Like, how is this working? How's this worked out? It's almost like he's got a playlist, and then he's gone, right, I'm going to write a film for this playlist. I'm not going to change any more music. I'm just going to go off this. And it's a really, really exciting but weird situation. But that's my not my favourite scene, but probably the scene that made me smile the most. And it was once you realise that the guns were going off to the drum beat, and every shot cut into a different character shooting the gun at a different time was a different drum sound. So that made it sound really, really original. And if there's anyone listening to this who hasn't seen the film, firstly, I don't know why I listen to this and not in the cinema, but try and notice that, because I think it's really fun. And that's almost a thread throughout the whole film. And I think I saw it the second time, you do notice that from the beginning. It's just that you almost haven't clicked onto it just yet. And that's what I really liked about the music and the scene combination.
Mate, I'm jealous you've seen it twice, to be honest. I'm just jealous now. I just want to go back and see it.
I want to see it the third time. I might go tomorrow.
Oh, mate, it's such a good film. That is song. That is Tequila by Button Down Brass. All these songs, you think you know them, and then they come into another song, and you can just see how many samples have been used by this kind of music. Do you know what I mean? I can't remember which song it is, but there's one which is, I thought was going to come into a Dr. Dre song, and it's just the start of a different song entirely.
Yeah, it's a sample from the Dre song, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. But I think it was before the Dre song. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it was.
And then there's a couple of other ones where, what's the House of Pain song where Jump Around? Dun, dun, dun. Is that Harlem Shuffle where it starts like that? I think it is. And that's the thing, there's these songs that you think, Christ, it's going to be this, that's exciting, and then it's something completely different, so it gives you complete misdirection. I've never known a soundtrack this in tune with a film before. Do you know what I mean? I've known great soundtracks, like incredible soundtracks. Forrest Gump's got one of the best ever soundtracks, but that's just hit after hit after hit through the decades and through the ages, you know. This, like you said, I think there's certain songs that he probably did plan before the scene. Do you know what I mean?
Because definitely.
I think I've heard him say that he would go through his catalogue because he knows this scene's going to be 2 minutes, so he'll filter things down by length. So I think there are scenes that he didn't know what he was going to use, and then probably had a great idea, but then just filtered them. But there's certain scenes you know have just been completely tailored to that style. And, I mean, it's so different. It's an upgrade on Scott Pilgrim, because Scott Pilgrim did have original music, and it's all about the bands and the battle of the bands and all this kind of stuff. And the scenes work extremely well, but those songs were written for the film. Do you know what I mean? And they were designed for that scene. Whereas he's picking songs that aren't designed for any scene. He's making the scene around the song. I mean, it's very, very clever, and unlike anything else. And I think you've got to appreciate the music and the art together to really get it. Do you know what I mean? It's not like everyone will get it and even take it into the detail that I certainly do and that other people do, but you could just watch the film. I don't know, you know it's the kind of film that you listen to the soundtrack and it flashes back to the film. That is how clever it is, and that's very rare. There's not films that do that very often, to be honest.
I'd also say as well, you know, some of these songs, I know me, I don't have you know, musical taste like yourself, Rory. I'm not as into music, to be honest with you. No. That's not to say I don't like music, but I'm not like, you know, I haven't got thousands of songs on my iPod.
Yeah, I'm basically I'm a mini Edgar Wright. I'm like a lower level, you know. No. I know a little bit about film and music and games and all that shit, but that's the kind of thing. I'm a bit of a geek.
Well, I wouldn't. Some of these songs I know that if I just heard them on the radio, I possibly wouldn't like some of them.
Yeah, but
I love them in this film, and the way they're done is so creative, and the work that has gone in to make everything sync up. You know, obviously he said himself, a lot of people think it's editing, but that's only a small part of it. Most of it is that they've actually just done everything choreographed to that music, and the skill and the effort from the director and the actors and everybody involved is just, it's breathtaking, really. It's just, you know, I think I remember Steven Spielberg described Lawrence of Arabia as a miracle of a film. Yeah. Obviously, for different reasons, that's an epic and different challenges in the desert and whatnot. But this is a miracle of a film in a way, because all these things work perfectly. You know, it would have been very easy for me, definitely, for some of these things for me to have gone, oh, that's too far, or, you know what I mean? But it's just perfectly balanced, and he knows exactly how much to use and how much not to use, and, you know, how long to have these chase scenes and these scenes, and just perfection, really. It really is. It's just the...
I think that's the thing with films like this. You normally get a sense that either they're too long, or they're cramming into too big an action scene, or they do, you know, there's something that feels a little bit out of place, or they lull. Most films have a really big dip in the middle where they kind of don't know whether to turn it on, you know, and go for the big closing scene. They're kind of building the anticipation or whichever way they do it. This doesn't have an ounce of fat on it, does it? Do you know what I mean? It feels like, you know, it's a 2-hour film. And what surprised me, like, you know, Nolan films and Jackson films are always like 2 hours 40, 3 hours, these kind of ridiculously long films, which are great because they are... But sometimes, I think Mad Max is about 2 hours, sometimes you go and see a film and you just, it keeps your attention the entire time, which is quite rare. It is, because you'll often go and see a film and just sometimes lose interest a little bit and it brings you back round. But yeah, I just thought it's just the perfectly produced film, you know, and that's the thing. It's not just about all the other stuff we're waxing lyrical about. It's literally, it's this is the director's cut. Do you know what I mean? Like when you see films and go, oh Christ, I wish you could feel the director wanted to add a bit more in there, or, you know, they've always talked about doing 4 hours of footage and they've got to get it down to 2 hours. This feels like they shot exactly what he wanted. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like nothing more, nothing less, really.
Totally. And obviously we've talked about Edgar Wright and his love of pop culture and you know, passion for things. And one of the things he's really good at doing is capturing the magic or the love that people have that doesn't necessarily always get reflected in films and things, for something as simple as, you know, walking with your iPod onto a song you love. There is a joy to that is just amazing. You actually sometimes feel you're walking faster than you would any other time. And obviously the odds are you're not. But it feels that way. And I think that scene with Bell Bottoms and him walking to the coffee shop is just magical. That's the scene I will, you know, that's the scene for me that just, you know, as you say, with the sort of the names popping up as graffiti, the words popping up as graffiti on the walls and things. It's just so creative, and it's just a bit special, really. Just magical, isn't it? It really is.
Yeah, mate, I completely agree, actually. I didn't even look at it from that perspective. He does, I mean, going back, albeit quickly, to Hot Fuzz, and, oh God, I can't remember his name now, Nick Frost's character in that, when he's saying, have you ever driven a car and shot a gun at the same time? Have you ever jumped in the air and shot a gun? Have you ever done this? Have you ever been stabbed? Have you ever shot a man? Have you ever cooked a fool or whatever he says? You know? I love that scene because that's him basically, you know, it's that similar kind of thing where he's going, have you ever done this? Because I love action films, and I'm in this sleepy town where nothing happens. And then obviously at the end of that film, it's all about him shooting while he's driving, and all these kind of carb suits and hot, you know, all that kind of stuff. And yeah, he does do that. You know, Edgar Wright is, I don't know, he's got that great imagery on taking what you would do in these situations, potentially, you know, especially Shaun of the Dead, and kind of, I mean, the Shaun of the Dead one's always the classic where it's people looking at their phones and already being zombies when they're not zombies, do you know what I mean? Yeah. That kind of thing. Yeah. Yeah, he does have a very, very clever way of doing that. And yeah, I was in London, headphones on, last couple of days. Much happier with my headphones on in London, let's put it that way. And putting Massive Attack on, and you know, that takes you back to the video and all that kind of stuff. And it is that, man. Yeah, you do envisage yourself in his style and his films, especially if you connected that way. And yeah, that's the films that really connect with you, I think. And that's what makes it a little bit more, you know, that's what hits it home a little bit more, because, you know, that's what we said why we're rooting for Baby, you know, because he's just like your everyday guy who maybe, you know, will find himself in the wrong situation and is struggling to get out of it, really. So, yeah, it's a very good point.
Mm-hmm. I'm just aware of the time. So what were your thoughts on the end of the film, and in particular, Baby giving himself up, really? Some people, it didn't work for them. What were your thoughts on that, Luke?
I really liked it, because I think it's one of them, isn't it, where I don't think you really expect, so although there's a belated happy ending, obviously after the 5 years he spends in prison, but I think it's nice that it isn't just a happy ending straight away, do you know? I think you could always say, because I think it's almost that, as you go through the film, it's almost that kind of classic American kind of 1950s film, isn't it? Really got the love interest, you've got the bad situation, and it's almost he's kind of heroically putting himself forward to get kind of captured. And then you'd imagine, as the witnesses in the stand are going through all the testimonies about how he's, you know, essentially a good guy in an unfortunate situation, you'd kind of expect it to go, okay, well, in the light of this, la la la, you know, we'll let you off. But it's nice that he goes, no, 25 years, but possibly you'll be let out after 5. And I kind of thought, I like that a lot. Like, I really like the fact that he just kind of, you've done this crime and you've been caught and you've gone to prison, albeit not for the full 25 years. But it's just a nice way of kind of, again, distancing itself from maybe what you'd expect from any other film, I suppose, really. So that the ending worked for me. I'd probably been more disappointed in possibly kind of the writing and the directing and kind of the whole production of the film if they'd have just would have just kind of, like they say, drove off into the sunset, if you like. So it was nice. Yeah, I liked it.
Yeah.
I didn't want it to go Bonnie and Clyde, you know. I didn't want the whole drive off and, you know.
Yeah.
And I would have been more pissed off if that had happened, certainly.
Because I think,
although he did commit crimes, you know, she is entirely innocent in all of this. I mean, she didn't even know he was a criminal until 40 minutes to go. Do you know what I mean?
It's a pretty hard thing
to meet someone a couple of days before and then basically be, you know, put in jail, presumably also if they'd driven off and got caught, do you know what I mean? Or they'd been on the run their whole life and it wouldn't have been an accomplice type thing, exactly. And it would have been that, and it wouldn't have sit right as well. I mean, they got their minutes or two of her driving and him waking up and their moment together, albeit a brief one, but then ultimately the kind of, you know, the goodwill wins out, really. And I think everyone, you know, died who should have done, let's put it that way, do you know what I mean? And, I think everyone got their comeuppance in the kind of right way. It was, I did like the court scene when it was people giving evidence and it was the woman he stole his car but she gave back his handbag, do you know what I mean? I mean, that's a great scene when he does the full donut and chucks the bag out of the car and she says, what the fuck, it's just a genius thing. I thought, you know, it was a subtle enough ending. I didn't think it was going to go that way. I thought it was going to go full on explosions and you don't know, or maybe drive us into the sunset and cut that kind of thing. And I think that would have been disappointing. I think it got the kind of, it got the ending it that was right morally and otherwise. And I think that's important. I think I can see why people wanted the whole, it doesn't play out like a typical action film at the end. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't have that big, there's no, you know, Michael Bay explosion. Do you know what I mean? There's no helicopters on fire or, you know, tanks or any shit like that. Do you know what I mean? It's a huge foot chase and everything that happens goes wrong. And, you know, baby having his perfect kind of normal getaway and everything completely goes where he's hiding behind a tree for God's sake and trying to escape on foot and jumping cars and all the rest of it. It all spirals. But ultimately everything happens for the right reasons, and bar a kind of almost Halloween-esque John Hamm at one stage, I thought it was an almost perfect film and perfect ending, really.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think I like the fact, like you both said, that it had weight. You know, people had been hurt in these crimes, although obviously he was forced into it. The film had a weight. There were consequences to these cars travelling around and, you know, pulling off these heists at high speed and having these gun battles impact cities. You know, I like that they had weight. And I also like that his actions, despite us knowing that essentially he was a good person, it had weight, that he was ultimately punished and he chose to take that punishment because, partially, I think, because he felt he deserved it partially, but also because, as you both said, because he didn't want Deborah to become an accomplice when she, you know, she'd had no time to think about it, and he didn't want to live him with that, or, you know, living in fear for the rest of her life. So I like that, and I like that it was different. I like that it wrong-footed me in the cinema and many other people. And again, that's another thing Edgar Wright's so good at. It, you know, you don't get exactly what you expect, and that's a good thing to me. Obviously, as I say, I'm aware of the time. So just a final question, really. Is there anything, any other performances or scenes or anything like that, moments that stand out for you that we haven't mentioned that you'd just like to give a bit of love to, Rory?
I mean, we've obviously talked about them, but I think the action scenes, the car scenes, particularly the opening one in Subaru, is probably one of the finest car scenes I've ever seen, because there's no CG, man, and it was quite a welcome relief to go to a film that isn't, you know, 3D IMAX, that isn't all the CG and green screens and special effects, and this car scene was done for real, man, and that whole, you know, where Bernthal, you know, points forward and he goes in reverse and then does that ridiculous move around those two cars, and you watch that. And how close is he to those cars, and that is real. Do you know what I mean? That's real stunt driving, and that's magnificent. I mean, that, and the camera work on that is just crazy good. And I
you
said,
feel a difference, don't you, Rory? You feel a difference when it's real cars doing real stunts. There's a difference.
You do, man. Yeah, there's a massive difference. I think I'm a massive advocate of Mad Max, and the scenes in Mad Max that are way over the top and not real. But the bulk of Mad Max is filmed in Australia, is filmed in areas, and it is actually happening. Do you know what I mean? And you get the tension from that. And I think when films are done right, it just, like that, it feels great. And the one other quick thing to say is I love films, and there's not many of them. Drive does it, and Collateral of a few years ago, and this, where it's just got those kind of cityscapes, you know, and I thought Atlanta was a really good choice.
I love that.
I love when they pan out, especially at night, and you get that kind of buzz of the city, because, you know, it feels really special. Films that do that, I just always got a soft spot for, basically, and I love films that have always done that. Drive certainly does that, and it's got some Drive, you know, it's got some familiar feels of Drive to it, the soundtrack and the styling and stuff, but it's completely different in its style. But those kind of panoramic city shots and stuff, it does, you know, I it's nice to see Edgar Wright given a budget to do those kind of shots, let's put it that way, anyway, you know.
Definitely. What about yourself, Luke?
Scene wise, obviously talked about before, I think the dining scene, because I think you could feel the tension building between like the kind of the four core characters carrying out the post office heist. You could kind of feel it. I think the temperature increasing a little bit, but I didn't expect that, basically, because I think I'm a really big kind of horror stroke thriller fan. Like I like that feeling of almost, oh, I can't stand this. It's almost you can feel the tension, and that came out of absolutely nowhere. So that would probably be my favourite scene, just purely for what it made me feel while I was actually in the cinema. Because, you know, you've got the beginning of the film, it's very jovial, you know, he's running around in the street, you know, singing and dancing to, like, you know, whatever song it is or whatever mix it is. And then you've got, obviously, he's singing Deborah in the flat with his foster father, and that's very nice. That's a really lovely couple of scenes. And then they go kind of, it drops you straight out of the air into that. So I really like that. But I think in terms of, like, my favourite, like, line almost, and this is kind of just comes from my, like, absolute love of, like, Disney and Pixar, is where in the first half of the film, he's watching Monsters, Inc., isn't he? And they say, like, you and I, we're going to have a friendship forever. And then in the middle, he uses that line to Doc. And then a little bit later on, he says, you know, of course, I'm good for it. You know, you and I, we'll be friends forever. And then I've just had to actually
search Twitter for the actual quote, but he says, "Don't feed me any more lines from Monsters, Inc. That pisses me off." And it's like, it's just a really lovely bit of, like, humour. And he says, "I know what it's from. I'm not stupid. It's Sam's favourite film, who's obviously his nephew."
Oh, that nephew had a couple of great lines as well.
Yeah, he was a corker, wasn't he? He was an understated hero of the film, wasn't he?
I think one other quick thing, Joe, Jamie Foxx's death in that scene, I mean, that was brutal, but the aftermath of that, you know, where he can't move, where baby's just completely in shock, and, you know, that pause on screen and that noise, you're just feeling the tension, man. I mean, that's genius, because you just feel every inch of what the hell's just happened, and that's baby feeling, you know, that the guy got, you know, the innocent security guard got shot because of, he feels like it's him, you know, and he has to take retribution. And I just thought, yeah, I think some people have doubted whether he intentionally killed him. He did. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
the other thing he does, which Edgar Wright has admitted, is he turns the airbag off. So Jamie Foxx has got no chance.
Yeah.
Leans over and turns the airbag off. So, yeah, I mean, it's all very intentional. I mean, that is an attention to detail, isn't it, from director to do something so subtle as that. But, yeah, that scene and that start of the chase scene is just... the tension is incredible. It really is.
I think that's a great place to end it, really. I've enjoyed hearing both your thoughts. It makes me want to, the best compliments I can give is it makes me want to watch the film again even more than I already did, which is saying something, because I was already desperate to see it again. So thanks very much to you both. Where can people find more of your work, Rory?
Yeah, maybe not on Twitter at the minute. I'm not the most optimistic of Liverpool fans right now, but it sounds like there's some good news on the horizon, so maybe I'll come around. If you want to listen to me talking anything about films and stuff, it's either on here or it's on at AI Comic Pod. We've been talking Spider-Man lately and Guardians of the Galaxy, and got Wonder Woman to come quite soon and some other good stuff. It's been a big year for our kind of style of and genre, so good stuff for that. And then there is an article which I briefly mentioned before, which is in conjunction with this. It's a review on the film and a kind of a different take on it, I would hope, a bit more from the kind of eyes of the director seat, and I think it's pretty decent, so hopefully people will check that out as well.
I've read that, and I'm not just saying it is absolutely fantastic. Please check it out. It's excellent. That'll be on the AI site very soon. And what about yourself, Luke?
If you want to have a chat about the film or just about anything in general, I think Twitter's probably the best place to do it. As I'm starting to kind of move into a lot more writing about trying to get into music and film, that's where, like, I'll be posting a lot of me. Both my thoughts and my pieces as I crack on with the day job. So that's @LUKALL_. So @_LukeHall_.
Yeah, and I've read Luke's work on films before. Thoroughly recommend. Please check out his Twitter and also AI, where he's also done some film articles that are thoroughly
recommend reading, so please check those out. I'm Joe Simpson at JoeSimpson79 on Twitter or at AI Movie Night. As always, I'd thoroughly recommend you all to check out the AI app. It's free, and obviously it's got films, comic movies, it's got, you know, all sorts of sports, not just football. There's pretty much anything you want is on there. It's, you know, sports, it's got just a
something. Man, it's got everything on. Now every time it I has. Go on there's something else. There's an NBA one with Joe Connors, the Legend Pod's great. Gags is basically doing about 26 pods a week at the minute. But there's some really
good points.
Do you know, I speak quite honestly about it, man, but there's some insightful stuff. There's stuff that people don't thing to do, and it does push some boundaries, and I'm not just saying that. I do, you know, the work that goes behind it all, you know, we're all doing it for free. We just want to talk and get the feedback, and yeah, just thank anyone. And I do on the AI Comic Pod, we've had some really good numbers lately, and yeah, it's really good for people to check it all out, and we really do appreciate it.
Definitely yeah, thanks to everyone for listening.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.